So with Shavuot coming up, I thought we would learn today some different perspectives on Megillat Rut. In general, every year I'm struck that Megillat Rut stands out in many ways as being the most human and unassuming of the Sifrei Tanakh. I mean, its story is grand and yet also simple. It's about two women who experience loss together and then go on to rebuild their lives. And every year I'm struck by how personal and honest the story really is and the way that it depicts the process of loss and recovery in a very authentic way. So in order to appreciate that more, I think it's instructive to first begin by comparing the depiction of loss and the feelings of Ruth and Naomi as described in the Megillah to the many other stories of bereavement that we find throughout Tanakh. There are really a lot of stories throughout Tanakh of parents who lose their children. So I'd like to start. The first chart on your source sheet includes the psukim of almost all of the parents in Tanakh who lose children, and I'd like to start by analyzing the differences between those stories. The very first parent in the world, Adam, loses Hevel after Cain kills him, and what we see in his reaction is that afterwards his wife gives birth to Sheet, and it says, "Vayeda Adam od et ishto, batele ben betikra et shmo Sheet, ki shat li Elokim zera acher tachat Hevel, ki harago Cain." So the way that Adam approaches his loss is really by trying to move on. We see very little emotion expressed within these psukim. He just says, "Hashem gave me another child tachat Hevel," to sort of replace Hevel instead of Hevel. We see really an absence of emotion expressed here and a desire to move on, to look toward the future and try to rebuild through the birth of this new child. The next parent that we find who loses a child, although, of course, it turns out that child has not actually been killed, is Yaakov, who believes that he has lost Yosef. And his expression of emotion could not possibly be more different from Adam's. And his emotion, as expressed in these psukim, is inconsolable and insurmountable grief. What he says is, he tears his clothes, v'yetabel al b'no yamim rabim, he's in mourning for many days, v'yakumu kol b'na v'chol b'notav l'nachamo, everyone tries to comfort him, v'yima'in, and he refuses to be comforted, v'yima'in l'hitnachim, he refuses to be comforted, v'yomer ki ered al b'ni abel she'ola v'yevcho to'aviv, he says, I will go down to my grave mourning for my son. So this, again, could not possibly be more different than Adam's response. This is a fully expressed deep grief, and in fact, to the extent that Rashi almost finds something a little bit unnatural about it. And Rashi says that the reason Yaakov felt so much grief was actually because Yosef wasn't dead, that there was a certain closure lacking, and that in a case where there had been greater closure and where Yosef had actually died, Yaakov wouldn't have felt this extreme form of grief. And Rashi finds something very surprising about the extent of Yaakov's grief here. The next parent we find is Yehuda, who loses his first two children. And his response is interesting and I think very realistic. He says he's concerned about Tamar marrying his third child, Shelah. So he says to Tamar Kalato, Shvi almana beit avich ad yigdal Shelah, like, don't marry him yet. Ki amar pen yamut gam hu ke'echav. And in his heart, what he's saying, what he doesn't express to Tamar, is that he's afraid of what's going to happen to Shelah. That if he lets Shelah marry Tamar, that Shelah may also meet the same fate as his older brothers. And I think this also represents a very realistic response to loss that's very human and natural, of feeling particularly protective of the next child, of being afraid that a similar tragedy will happen in the future, and therefore sort of retreating and being more protective of the loved ones one still has. In the story of Aaron, who loses his two sons, what we see is also different, and it's very interesting to me that through all of these depictions of grief in Tanakh, none of them is the same. And to me, that sort of speaks of the humaneness of Tanakh, that it gives so many different valid responses to grief, that it understands and endorses that different people will feel differently in these situations, and that there's room for all of that within the stories of people we look up to in Tanakh. So Aaron's response after Moshe speaks to him, tries to comfort him for the deaths of his children, is just, Vayidom Aharon, and Aaron was silent. So here, we have the sense that there's something very deep going on. It's not a lack of emotion, but that it's totally inward, that it's hidden from us, exactly what Aaron is experiencing in this situation. He chooses to turn his grief inward and to sort of deal with it on a deep level in a way that's not apparent to outside observers. And we also find in Sefer Shoftim, Aim Sisra, who's not someone we particularly look up to, but is also a bereaved mother in Tanakh who does inform some of our ritual, even. We think about her with regard to the kolos of the shofar and Rosh Hashanah. And what she expresses is a certain dread. We see in the first pasuk of her, that's quoted here for Aim Sisra, Ba'ad hachalon nishkafa v'tiyabev Aim Sisra. She's like moaning as she looks out the window. But then she goes on, her friends in Pasuk Kaf Tet tell her, and then it says, Avhi Tashiv Amareha La, and then she started also telling herself that maybe in Pasuk Lamed, Halo Yimtzu Yechalku Shalau, she starts sort of trying to tell herself, it's natural, that he's only late because he's been victorious in war, and he's dividing all of the plunder. So on the one hand, you can have the sense she doesn't really believe that. I mean, she is crying and moaning through the window, but she's also sort of trying to get herself to believe that everything's really okay. It's this sense of dread of looking toward the future, of real like fear, to the extent of trying to convince oneself that the reality is actually different than what it is. In Shmuel Bet, when David loses his baby with Bathsheba, we see that before the death of the baby, he does all to, you know, he fasts and he davens, but then afterwards he gets up immediately. And when his servants turn to him in Pasuk Kaf Aleph and say, "What are you doing? Like when the baby was still alive, you fasted and you cried. And now you're fine. Now that the tragedy actually occurred." And David's response is, he said, "When there was the baby was still alive, I thought maybe there was something I could do to sort of change Hashem's mind. But now that he has died, why would I fast? Can I bring him back?" And he goes on, "V'yenachem David et Bathsheba ishto," and he goes on to try to comfort Bathsheba. So here the response is one of a very rational response, like very cerebral, sort of saying very matter of fact, trying to move on, saying, "I'm going to do the responsible thing and try to comfort my wife and do whatever I can to move past this." It's a very cerebral and not, while emotion was expressed while the baby was alive, in the face of loss, David tries not to approach it with that full expression of emotion, but rather in a more matter of fact and cerebral way. Let's look at a couple more before we go into our discussion of Ruth. The Isha, I didn't include Shimshon, who also dies. There's not much really said about him. The Isha Shunamit, after her baby that Elisha promised her dies, she, in Malachim Bet Perek Dalet, has the response of just turning to Elisha. She just does not accept it. She says when she sees the child has died, she just gets on her donkey and goes off and says, "That's it. I'm going to find Elisha and make him do something about this." And she does, and that's, I guess, the nice thing about having a Navi involved in your life, that you can do stuff like that. But she actually turns to Elisha, and she just refuses to accept it. She said, "That's it. You promised me this baby, and he's gone, and that's, you better do something about it." And Elisha does, and he actually brings the baby back to life. So it represents this sort of activism, which obviously most people, you know, would not have this type of recourse to someone like Elisha. But at the same time, I think the emotional expression of activism and like refusing to accept one's fate is something that we see expressed in different ways at times in people who've experienced a serious loss. The next two sources, Iyov and Rut, are what we're really going to focus on today, because there are many parallels between the Sefer of Iyov and of Rut. Iyov's response when his children die is very philosophical. In Pasuk Kaf Aleph of Iyov Perek Aleph, Iyov says after his children die, "Arom yatzati mibetanimi va'arom ashuv shama. Hashem natan v'Hashem lakach yihi shem Hashem avarach. I came out from my mother's womb naked, and I will return the same way. Hashem gave and Hashem took, yihi shem Hashem avarach." So it's an entirely philosophical response to grief. Now it's true that later in the Sefer, when Iyov experiences even more devastation, including physical illness, that he he does express more of a sense of crisis. He doesn't stay quite this detached throughout the whole Sefer. But still, the Sefer itself entirely, even at all points, is a very philosophical one. Eov at all points, even within the moment of loss, tries to approach his loss by understanding it through a philosophical lens, rather than through the lens of emotion. In our last source in Ruth, Naomi's response when her children die is the most multifaceted and complex, whereas we've seen a range of responses until now. Within each response, there seems to be one sort of prevailing emotion or approach. Within Naomi, it's much more complicated. She doesn't seem to just embody one response to her children's death. So I underlined several psukim in this source so that it would be easier for you to find. We're going to actually start with the middle one that's underlined, Ki Marli Ma'od Mikem. Naomi turns to her daughters-in-law after this loss and says, Ki Marli Ma'od Mikem, Ki Yatza Bi Yad Hashem. Marli Ma'od Mikem can mean a couple of different things. It's an ambiguous pasuk. It could mean it's more bitter for me than for you. My loss is more serious than yours, presumably because her daughters-in-law have the option of going back to Moab and remarrying, whereas Naomi really doesn't have options like that. So it could be just an expression of sadness and grief. Marli ma'od mikem, I'm in an even worse position than you are. Or Marli ma'od mikem has another meaning as well that's equally plausible in the words, which is that I am bitter because of you. I've experienced this loss because of you. In which case, what she would be saying is that this would align with the reading that the reason that her sons died was because they had married Moabite women, that she would be saying, I'm suffering because of this sin that my children committed by marrying you. In which case, it's not an expression of grief. It's actually an expression of tzedek hadin. It's actually justifying Hashem's ways and saying, it's understandable why this happened. This happened because of sin. This was an act of divine justice. Similarly, when she says, Ki yatza bi yad Hashem, on the one hand, that sounds like a complaint against Hashem, an expression of the grief that she's experiencing. But on the other hand, it could also just as plausibly also be read as tzedek hadin, as Naomi accepting that her losses weren't random, that her losses were meted out by divine justice. Yatza bi yad Hashem. It's Hashem who did this to me, and therefore presumably justified. And in fact, this is in keeping with Naomi's sort of hashtafa throughout this parak, in that earlier in the parak, the first line that's underlined, she says to her daughters-in-law, as she's wishing them good luck, she says, Ya'as Hashem imachem chesed ka'asher asitem im hametim v'imadi. May Hashem do chesed for you, as you have done for the dead and for me. Which implies that at least on some level, Naomi accepts the concept of divine justice in the world. She believes in that. She believes that Hashem acts in response to people's actions. So it could very well be that even her expressions of grief include a sense that there was justice in it as well. Similarly, in the last couple of psukim that are underlined, which express far more bitterness and grief, Naomi says, "Vatomer aleihen al tikrena li Naomi, kraena li mara, ki hemar shakai li ma'od." Hashem has made me very bitter. Ani malei'a halachti v'reikan hashivani Hashem. I find this one of the most poignant expressions of loss in Tanakh. I went out full, and Hashem returned me empty. Lama tikrena li Naomi, v'Hashem anabi v'shakai heirali. So on the one hand, this doesn't really sound like tzedek hadin. This sounds like heart-wrenching emotion. At the same time, both Ibn Ezra and Rashi read that word of anabi, that Hashem answered against me, as referring to a court case, as in the Aseres Hadiros, lo tana bereyacha et sheker. And that what it really means, the way both Rashi and Ibn Ezra would translate this pasuk, is that Hashem tried me. He put me on trial. And I lost. So the implication is that there was justice here. There is tzedek hadin. There was, I got due process and I lost. So I find that within Naomi's response, there's a complicated blend of, on the one hand, expressing extreme grief, and on the other, recognizing Hashem's justice in the world and accepting that. And I find that this sort of complicated blend is in keeping with the Sefer as a whole, the very human and realistic portrayal of relationships and of loss in the Sefer, because that her response is so much more multifaceted and includes more conflicting emotions than I think we see in any other story within Tanakh of loss. So until now, I focused on the personal nature of the story of Ruth, which I think is essential to appreciating the richness and honesty of the Sefer that I think are so distinctive about it. There's another dimension to the Sefer as well that is less personal and perhaps more philosophical. Several authors, including Rav Meidan and Rav Bazak, both of Yeshivat Har Etzion, have noted that in addition to telling Ruth's personal story of loss and redemption, Megillat Rut also grapples seriously with the philosophical problem of tzaddik v'ra lo in the world. And in fact, there are many thematic and conceptual and linguistic points of comparison between Megillat Rut and Sefer Iyov, which is, of course, a more famous dealing with that, with biblical treatment of that problem of tzaddik v'ra lo. So the next chart on your source sheet explains some of the parallels between Iyov and Ruth. And all of these parallels point to the fact that both Sfarim share a similar concern with understanding Hashem's justice and Hashem's mercy in the world, not only in the context of Ruth's personal story, but also in a broader and more philosophical plane. First of all, of course, the most basic comparison is that both in the very first parak of their Sefer lose both their children and possessions and experience devastating loss. Also, both of them attribute their misfortune to Hashem explicitly. Iyov says, "Chay kel hisir meshvati v'shakai limar nafshi," and Naomi, in one of the psukim that we read earlier, also attributes her misfortune to Hashem by saying Shakai Himar Shakai Nimaud, and both of them also use Shem Shakai to refer to Hashem, that divine name, which is an unusual one and particularly unusual in narrative sections of Tanakh. In both cases, their loss is so extreme that when other people see them, they can't believe how much devastation Iyov and Ami have experienced. Iyov's friends look at him, and Iyov parak bet pasuk yedet, and it just says, lo hiki ruhu. They couldn't even recognize him. He was just a new person because of what he had experienced. They just were completely shocked and devastated to the point that they themselves started crying and tearing their clothes. And similarly, when Naomi comes back to Beit Lechem Yehuda, everyone who looks at her, Fatehom kol ha'ir alehem, Vatomarna hazot Naomi, everyone who looks at her is astonished and says, could this be Naomi? So both of them experience devastation to an extent that is obvious to other people, and everyone around them is just shocked. In the end, there's a happy ending for both of them, and moreover, that ending is described in similar terms. Iyov has 7 sons, while Naomi is told that Ruth is asher hi tovalach mishiv abanim, meaning Naomi doesn't have 7 sons, but she has Ruth, who is explicitly compared in the pshat to 7 sons. She's as good for you as 7 sons. The ends of these Sfarim and they are also similar. Iyov sees 4 generations, like he Iyov acharei zot me'ava arba'im shana v'yireh et banav et b'nei banav arba'adah rot. He sees 4 generations, and similarly, Sefer Ruth ends 4 generations after Ruth. There's also it's also possible that they lived in the same historical time period. Ruth lived b'mei shvot hashoftim. It says that explicitly in Pshat. And there is one opinion in the Gemara, the opinion of Rabbi Elazar, that Iyov also lived b'mei shvot hashoftim. So all of these similarities in the text between Ruth and Iyov point to the fact that they share an important concern. They're both preoccupied with understanding the reasons for human suffering in this world. But the solutions that Iyov and Ruth achieve are entirely different. In fact, there's an article by a biblical scholar named J.A. Loder in which he refers to Ruth as Job's sister because he feels that she shares Iyov's concerns with the problem of tzaddik v'ra lo, but resolves the problem in an entirely different, in her own unique way, which he actually sees as being related to the fact that she's a woman. Sefer Iyov goes through the first many prakim of Sefer Iyov detail the arguments of Iyov's friends, who articulate various philosophical approaches to sort of help Eeyore come to terms with the loss that he's experienced. Various philosophical approaches to the problem of tzaddik v'ra'lo. And primary among these approaches is the concept that there is midat hadin in the world, that Hashem is just, and that if you, they say to Eeyore that if this happened to you, it must be because you did something wrong. This approach is ultimately rejected when Hashem speaks to Eov directly. And there are nuanced differences between the different approaches of Eov's friends, but that's really the primary approach that they take. Ultimately, Hashem speaks to Eov directly, but what he does in these psukim, in Prekim Lamed Chet through Mem Aleph of Sefer Eov, in all of the Prekim where he's speaking to Eov, he really rejects Eov's question rather than answering it. In the next verse, in Eov Perek Lamed Chet, this is very typical of what Hashem says throughout these prekim to Eov. He says, Miza machshich etza b'milin gilidat. Who is this who is obscuring understanding with words that have no knowledge? Azor na kegever chalatzechav eshalcha v'hodieni. Pull yourself together, and I'm going to ask you, and you tell me. Eifu hayita b'yasti aret, hageid im yagdata bina. Where were you when I put the world together? You tell me if you understand. Because basically, his response throughout these prakim is that man has no choice but to accept the mystery and inscrutability of God's will. Sefer Eov considers the problem of tzaddik v'ra'lo from the perspective of Hashem, rather than really from the perspective of man. The message of Hashem to Eov is that Hashem is all-knowing and unknowable, and that is just the mystery of accepting a human being's role in the world. So again, he doesn't answer the problem, but rather rejects or perhaps overcomes it. And in fact, it's interesting. I came across this a couple of years ago and found it so interesting. The Malbim says in his Hakdama to Sefer Eov that the Malbim agrees with the position in the Gemara that Eov was written by Moshe. And the Malbim explains that Moshe wrote this Sefer when he was in Mitzrayim, during the period of the enslavement in Mitzrayim, when he was trying to come to terms with the suffering of the Jewish people in Mitzrayim. And this was how he sort of worked through it intellectually. He wrote this Sefer to try to think about all the possible reasons that this could be happening to his people. So in addition to just giving some interesting context for that, what I find particularly of note about that approach is that what the Malbim is really saying is that a person could not only read Sefer Eov and not feel that they have real answers to the problem of tzaddik v'ra'lo, but a person could even write Sefer Eov and still feel that he doesn't have the answers to tzaddik v'ra'lo, because Moshe, as soon as he has an opportunity later in Sefer Shmot, in Parshat Ki Tisa, he turns to Hashem and asks him, Harini nat kvodecha, hodieni nat drachecha, which Chazal understands as Moshe asking Hashem, please explain to me how your mercy works in the world. Explain to me why there is such a phenomenon of tzaddik v'ra'lo. So if you accept the Malbim's approach that Moshe wrote Sefer Eov during Shibud Mitzrayim, and sort of put that together with the fact that later in the Sefer, Moshe turns to Hashem himself as soon as he has an opportunity and said, can you please explain to me why there is tzaddik v'ra'lo in the world? It helps you understand the problems that are actually left unresolved by Sefer Eov. That Sefer Eov says, you have to come to terms with the fact that you don't understand, but it obviously doesn't give real answers, because Moshe himself, who was possibly the author, still felt that he didn't have the answers, even after having written the Sefer, and took his first opportunity to turn to Hashem for an explanation. Interestingly, there's another Sefer Tanakh that asks the same questions as Sefer Eov and proposes the same answers, but from an entirely different angle. My colleague at Maya Note, Devorah Wolf, who's a teacher in the Gemara and Tanakh departments, pointed out to me that Sefer Yonah also is essentially another formulation of the Eov story, but it's told from an entirely different angle. Because while this story of Eov is about a series of seemingly undeserved tragedies, Eov just experiences loss after loss and it seems to have no reason whatsoever, Yonah is about a series of seemingly undeserved kindnesses. That Yonah, at the beginning of the Sefer, rejects Hashem's nevuah, tries to run away from Hashem, which would seem to be a tremendous rebellion against Hashem, and yet somehow Hashem never gives up on him. Hashem makes him be saved by the fish and delivered safely and continue his prophetic mission, and then he even gives him he plants the kikayon for him, and Hashem just never seems to give up on Yonah throughout the whole Sefer, as much as Yonah himself tries to distance himself from Hashem. And similarly, the people of Nineveh in that sefer clearly have done many evil things. All their evil has gone up before me. And yet the whole point of the sefer is that Hashem won't give up on them, that he'll do whatever he needs to make Yonah deliver his prophetic message so that the people can do tshuva, which ultimately happens. So like Eov, Yonah is preoccupied with understanding Hashem's mercy in the world. But for Eov, the question arose because Eov perceived a lack of divine mercy in the world, because he felt that he was experiencing so many tragedies that were undeserved. Whereas for Yonah, the question is the mirror image. For Yonah, the question is not, he's puzzled by the presence of Hashem's mercy in the world, not by its absence. And he just doesn't understand why Hashem would create a world that doesn't work with straight midas hidden, that does include so much mercy. In the next source on your sheet, from Yonah Perek Yemot Tadalad, Yonah says this explicitly. After, in Pasuk Yud, Hashem sees that Nineveh has done tshuva, Yibinachim ha'elokim al ha'ra'ah, asher diber la'asot lehem v'lo asah, he decides not to destroy them, but instead to forgive them. Vayera al Yonah ra'ah gadolah v'yicharlo. Yonah saw this as being very bad, and it upset him. He says to Hashem, this is why I ran away, because I didn't want this to happen. Because I know that you're so merciful, and I did not want this to happen. Please just take my soul away from me. Just kill me, because I would rather be dead than alive. Vayomer Hashem, hahitev charalach, is it really bothering you this much that there's divine mercy in the world? So, in other words, Yonah has the exact, it's again, it's the same problem as Eov, but from the opposite perspective. Yonah is concerned about the presence of divine mercy, whereas Eov is concerned about its absence. And there are even similarities in the words with which the stories of Yonah and Eov are told. Most Nevi'im, at the beginning of their sefer, are introduced with genealogy and historical context. We know what king lived during their time. For example, in Hosea and in Amos, both of them are introduced with significant historical context. We know both their own personal lineage as well as the kings during whom they prophesied. Yonah, by contrast, the sefer just begins, Vayihi Dvar Hashem al Yonah ben Amitai Lemor. We don't know when this was, where this was, we don't know who Amitai was, or anything like that. And similarly, Eov also sort of comes out of nowhere at the beginning of the sefer. Ishaya be'eretz utzu shmo Eov. It just says there was this man who lived in Eretz Utz, his name was Eov, that's it, the story begins. And this is why there's an opinion in the Gemara, and which is adopted by the Rambam, that Eov lo hayov lo nivra, that it's entirely metaphorical. The reason there's the room for this type of an approach to sefer Eov is because his beginning is so murky. He just seems to come out of nowhere, which gives the room for an opinion within Chazal and Rishonim that it never happens at all. So both Yonah and Eov are introduced without historical background, which indicates that they're both concerned with questions that are particularly timeless. They're ahistorical. They're both concerned with these like general global ahistorical questions of Hashem's mercy in the world, rather than being stories about a particular time. But Yonah, within his sefer, even though he's concerned with the same kind of questions, he takes the perspective not really of Eov himself, but more of Eov's friends, because Yonah does emphasize Midas Hadin in the world, just like Eov's friends did, and that is ultimately rejected. So in the story of Yonah, this question is really one of Rasha V'Tovlo, that we want. Yonah is trying to understand why there could be someone who doesn't deserve mercy and yet gets it. Whereas in the story of Eov, the question is one of tzadik hara lo, why there could be someone who is very good and yet experiences midas hadin. So Hashem rejects Yonah's approach throughout Sefer Yonah, just as he rejects the assumption of Eov's friends that Eov must have sinned in order to be punished so severely. And so to both Eov and Yonah, Hashem's answer is there is midas harachmim in this world. To Yonah, he just says, deal with it, there's midas harachmim, this is part of the identity of Hashem. And to Eov, he says, there is midas harachmim as you expected, but you may not always understand how it works. So Sefer Eov approaches the problem of tzadik hara lo through the lens of philosophical introspection. The question, as we said earlier, of tzadik hara lo isn't answered, but is rather overcome. Man can't comprehend the mind of God, must accept his own limitations and the mystery of Hashem, end of story. Megillat Ruth, as we noted earlier, is also preoccupied with the same question, but the solution is entirely different. The focus of Megillat Ruth throughout the entire Sefer is on people's relationships with each other. It's well known that chesed, that the word chesed, is a mila mancha, a recurring word throughout Megillat Ruth. And not only is it a mila mancha in a linguistic sense, but the entire Sefer is built on people's relationships with each other and people's acts of kindness for each other. Ruth and Orpah treat Naomi at the beginning with loyalty and kindness after the deaths of Mahlon and Kilion. Boaz treats Ruth with kindness by letting her glean in his field and making sure that she has crops to gather. Ruth then reciprocates by choosing Boaz over one of the younger men as the person that she wants to marry. And then Boaz responds in kind by agreeing to marry her, which is something that, for example, Ploni Almoni won't do. In addition, the halachic mechanism of Yibum plays a central role throughout all of Megillat Ruth, which is particularly fitting because Yibum is the ultimate chesed shel emet, the ultimate true chesed in that it represents a commitment to helping someone build a family even after he has passed away. In fact, the entire story of Sefer Ruth is very built upon the concept of chesed shel emet, in that it's basically a love story that begins essentially exactly when you would expect it to end. It begins when Ruth's husband dies, and yet much of the story is about expressions of her love for him. So the entire story, in addition to the fact that there are these small chasadim throughout of the living for each other, and that Yibum is such an important factor, the whole story is based on the concept of like a chesed that never dies, like a chesed shel emet that is a commitment that exists even after the death of a loved one. Not only is Megillat Ruth defined by small acts of chesed, but it's also unique in Tanakh in that it's the only story that really has no bad guys. It has no villains. While there is no one in the story who's evil, there are, however, characters who are sort of weaker foils for the protagonists. So, for example, Orpah is a weaker foil for Ruth. She's a good person, she does everything you could expect of her, but at the same time, she won't go to quite the extent that Ruth will out of her loyalty to Naomi. Similarly, as we mentioned earlier, Ploni Almoni is a decent person. He's a good guy, he's willing to redeem Elimelech's field, but he won't go to quite the extreme of marrying Ruth as Boaz is willing to do. So Ruth and Boaz stand out in this story, not because they're the only good people, but because they're the ones who are willing to take an extra level of risk, to go like just a bit further than what a normal nice person would do. And because they're unusually loyal to the people that they love. And moreover, they don't act this way out of a sense of strategy. You never have the sense that they're trying to accomplish a particular goal. It's not like, for example, in Megillat Esther, where you sort of have the sense that Mordecai and Esther know exactly what they want to accomplish and what they need to do to get there. You have a sense throughout Megillat Esther that there's a real plan. Whereas here, it's just these sort of unpremeditated acts of commitment and extreme loyalty that drive the whole Sefer forward. And in the end, the results of those acts of chesed are far greater than anyone, including Ruth and Boaz, could have anticipated. Not only is Megillat Ruth built on acts of chesed, but the language of the story is deliberately set up to harken back to the principal stories of chesed in the Torah, which are the stories of Abraham and Rivka at the well. So I gave you a couple of charts here with parallels between Abraham and Ruth and between Rivka and Ruth. So first of all, just like Abraham, Ruth leaves her family's home, leaves Moab, and it's described in similar terms. As with Abraham, Hashem says, "Lech lecha me'artzecha u'mimoladetcha u'mibet avicha el ha'aretz asher areka." Similar words are used when Boaz is talking to Ruth, and he says, "V'ta'azvi avich ve'imech ve'aretz moladetech." So Ruth is set up as following in the footsteps of Abraham in this way. And similarly, in Bereishit Perek Yud Gimel, when Abraham and Lot separate, and Abraham says, "Hi pared na me'alai im hasmol ve'imina ve'im hayamin ve'asmila," the words in Rut are reminiscent when she says, when Perek Aleph, Rut says to Naomi, "Ko yaseh Hashem li v'ko yasif ki hamavet yafrid beini uveinich." It's very similar language, but she's being set up as the opposite of Lot. It's reminding us of the Abraham story, but setting Ruth up not as being like Lot, but as being like Abraham. There are also a great number of parallels between Rivka and with the story specifically of Rivka at the well in Chaye Sara, which is, of course, another paradigmatic story of chesed in the Torah. So both the stories of Chaye Sara and of Rut begin with saying, in the case of Chaye Sara, that Abraham zaken babi yamin, that he was old, and in the beginning of Megillat Rut, of Naomi describing herself as zakanti miyod l'ish. Both of them return to their birthplace, include a story of someone returning to their birthplace at the beginning of the story. In Bereishis, it's Abraham telling his servant that you must go back to my birthplace. And in Rut, of course, the whole family goes, there's a return that happens right at the beginning of the story. Rut's response to Boaz is similar to Rivka's to Yitzchak. In Rut, it says, "Vatikol al panaha v'tishtachu arza." Just as with Rivka, it says, "Vatisai Rivka et inaha v'tirat Yitzchak v'tikol ma'al hagamal." She also just sort of falls off her camel in excitement, surprise, whatever it is. Continuing, they both receive in the second to last source. They both receive a similar bracha of having many children right when they get married. And both marriages, both the marriage between Rivka and Yitzchak, and between Rut and Boaz, are described as a nechama for a previous loss. In Yitzchak's case, by Yenachim Yitzchak acharei imo, that he is comforted for the death of his mother. And in Rut's case, that she says, "Nichantani v'chidibarta aliv shifatecha," you also, that Boaz comforted her for her loss. So not only is the story itself built on acts of chesed of people for each other, but even the words of the story of Megillat Rut deliberately reconstruct the most famous stories of chesed in the Torah. In other words, what Megillah is trying to accomplish is to set up its story as a recapitulation of those tales of chesed and to make us think of Rut in that way. So through its depictions of human relationships, Megillat Rut presents another way of overcoming the problem of tzaddik v'ra lo, and of making meaning out of tragedy, of the ways that people might move on with their lives after extreme loss. In Megillat Rut, people rebuild their lives by turning to other people. Where Eov addresses the problem of tzaddik v'ra lo on a grand scale, from the perspective of Hashem, Rut addresses it on a human scale. As Loder, the author that I mentioned earlier, as he writes, in his article, Rut conceives of God not as he is present in the cosmos, but as he's present in the barley field, as he appears in people's lives and their interactions with the people that they love. In Rut, people experience Hashem by being upstanding and loyal in their relationships with each other, and by creating a world order that's informed not only by justice, but by kindness. In Loder's article, he introduces Rut's chesed-oriented approach to human relationships with his heading, "Brothers and Sisters Are Different." So I don't know if it's exclusively true that this difference in response to tragedy that we see in the two Sfarim, Eov's response by turning to sort of philosophical introspection and trying to understand the mind of God, versus Ruth's response by turning to the people around her and trying to build a life of chesed, I don't know if that entirely falls out among gender lines, but I do think that the two Sfarim represent two very authentic and different and honest models of ways that people sometimes respond to loss in their lives. The perspective of Megillat Rut on tzaddik v'ra lo reminds me very strongly of the approach of the Rav in his article Kol Dodi Dofek, in which he talks about human responses to suffering and what he views as the most authentic halachic response. According to what he writes in his article, is that the most productive and authentic way to approach suffering is not to try to understand the philosophical meaning of evil, but in fact that almost explains away the problem when someone tries to do that. But rather, he says that the correct approach is to ask, what must the sufferer do so that he may live through his suffering? He writes that the fundamental question is, what obligation does suffering impose upon man? We do not inquire about the hidden ways of the Almighty, but rather about the path wherein man shall walk when suffering strikes. The Rav explicitly discusses Eov as representing that response of understanding the limits of recognizing the limits of man's understanding. But I think Megillat Rut fits in equally well to the general thesis of the Rav here as being a way of reconstructing meaning after tragedy by thinking about what to do next. And in this case, in the story of Megillat Rut, by turning to the other people in one's life and constructing relationships that are kind and redemptive, and that ultimately in the Megillah lay the groundwork not only for the personal redemption of the characters that we discussed at the beginning, but also for universal redemption ultimately. The Sefer Iyov is a well-known response to the timeless philosophical problem of Tzadik v'Ra'lo, and I think that Megillat Rut represents a less well-known but equally authentic response to this problem. And I think that it's a reflection of the humanity and honesty of Megillat Rut specifically, and of Tanakh as a whole, that in addition to providing so many different models for how a person might feel in the wake of tragedy, that the Tanakh also represents so many different models for what to do next, for how people sometimes can turn to rebuild their lives after experiencing that full range of emotions. Well, thank you for inviting me to learn with you today. Have a good Yom Tov.